That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Tech Meme Ride Home for Friday, June 28th, 2019. I'm Brian McCullough. Today, Johnny Ive is leaving Apple. Health Tech is having its first big IPO. Amazon looks like it's finally ready to kill UPS. I've got issues with Google's new reCAPTCHAs. And the weekend long read suggestions. Here's what you missed today in the world of tech. Well, no doubt you've heard the news by now. Shortly after I hit publish yesterday, word came down that Johnny Ive will officially leave Apple later this year. Now he will be forming a creative consulting business called Love From, with Apple as the first client. But make no mistake, the Johnny Ive era at Apple is over. There are several ways to cover this, beginning with the notion that this has been coming for a while. Around the whole Apple Watch launch, there were a slew of Johnny Ive profiles, especially the one in the New Yorker, that seemed to telegraph that Ive was stepping back from day-to-day work. Reportedly, he only came into the office twice a week at this point. You almost had the sense that Apple Watch was the last gadget design challenge that intrigued him. Then there was the Apple Spaceship HQ design, which seemed to be either his last true passion project or his last gift to Steve Jobs, seeing that through. Some wondered if designing an Apple car might be something to make Ive stick around, but you do get the sense that this has been in the works for a while, and all we're seeing right now is a well-orchestrated PR campaign to make sure investors don't freak out about Ive leaving too much. Then, of course, we could justly do encomiums about Ive's impact on modern life. It's not just that he was the preeminent product designer of the last 30 years, it's also that he was the very archetype of the modern designer full stop. It's not just that if the iPhone set the template for the modern smartphone, and as I said in my book, it's astonishing that Ive and Apple got the de facto design of the most influential item of modern life so conceptually perfect in their very first iteration. It's not just that Johnny's influence on the design of that means that he very directly influenced the contours of modern life. It's also that his influence on computing design, on gadgetry itself, on those little pocketable bricks of wonder, beginning with the iPod, mean that he has, more than anyone else, set the very aesthetic of modern life. Truly, Johnny is one of the most important people in technology over the last 50 years, perhaps 100 years. And by the way, he's not dead. He's still around. He'll still be working. He just won't be working at Apple anymore. And that leads me to another angle, the angle of maybe it's time? Several people have written hot takes about how over the last few years, Apple's products have gone down a bit of a design cul-de-sac. In Vice, Jason Kobler wrote about Ive's legacy in the last few years, pushing Apple's products towards designs that emphasize disposability, unrepairability, and frankly, just user unfriendliness, all in the aid of Ive's favorite aesthetic choices. Kobler mentions things like headphone jacks going away, batteries glued, not screwed to devices, keyboards that don't work. Also, things could be made almost impossibly thinner and lighter, as if that was the only thing that really mattered. Seemingly, that's the only thing that seems to have mattered to Johnny over the last few years. Here's Ben Thompson speaking of how Ive essentially was allowed to pursue his aims unfettered at Apple after Steve Jobs' death. Quote, "Frankly, I'm not sure Ive's consolidation of power was entirely positive for Apple. iOS became more beautiful, but also less usable. It is a subtle shift that happened with the company's other products, particularly the Mac Pro and the MacBook Pro as well. That, though, is the usual route revolutions take. What is inspired at the beginning, making computers desirable, becomes tyrannical in the end," end quote. And then there is the very legitimate concern trolling going on with Ive's move. Essentially, Ive will not be replaced. Apple's design team leaders, Evans Henke and Alan Dye, will now report to COO Jeff Williams. Here's John Gruber, quote, "It makes me queasy to see that Apple's chief designers are now reporting to operations. This makes no more sense to me than having them report to the LLVM compiler team in the Xcode group. Again, nothing against Jeff Williams, nothing against the LLVM team, but someone needs to be in charge of design for Apple to be Apple, and I can't see how that comes from operations. I don't think that chief design officer should have been a one-off title created just for Johnny Ive. Not just for Apple, but especially at Apple, it should be a permanent C-level title. I don't think Ive ever should have been put in control of software design, but at least he is a designer. I don't worry that Apple is in trouble because Johnny Ive is leaving. I worry that Apple is in trouble because he's not being replaced," end quote. But in the end, I guess the best way to honor the man is to simply quote his own words about this move at this stage in his life. This is Ive in the Financial Times, quote, "There was an employee meeting a number of years ago, and Steve was talking. He said that one of the fundamental motivations was that when you make something with love and with care, even though you will probably never meet the people that you're making it for, and you'll never shake their hand, by making something with care, you are expressing your gratitude to humanity, to the species. I so identified with that motivation and was moved by his description. So my new company is called Love From. It succinctly speaks to why I do what I do," end quote. It looks like health tech is going to have perhaps its first high-profile IPO of the modern era. Livongo, which sells connected devices to monitor diabetes, has filed for an IPO saying it had $32.06 million in revenue in Q1 of 2019 with a net loss of $14.96 million, quoting CNBC. The company also said it had 164,168 enrolled diabetes members for the glucose monitors and test strips it provides as of March 31st, 2019. That's up from the 68,536 enrolled diabetes members it had in the year-ago quarter. The company got its start in 2012 with an offering that included glucose monitors and test strips for people with diabetes. It has subsequently expanded its scope to other medical conditions, including behavioral tech and weight loss. It has previously said that it has more than 600 self-insured employers and health plans signed up as customers who cover the cost of the service for their members, end quote. We knew this was coming, but it is nonetheless striking to realize we are nearing the point where Amazon could soon be delivering the majority of packages in the U.S. by itself. The majority of its own packages, I should clarify. According to Rakuten Intelligence, around 48% of Amazon packages in the U.S. are delivered by Amazon itself, not by third parties like UPS, FedEx, or the post office. As recently as Q1 of 2017, Amazon delivered less than 20% of packages itself. The biggest loser since then has been the USPS, which used to deliver more than 60% of Amazon packages and now only delivers 33.3%. UPS's share of Amazon deliveries has held roughly steady at around the 15 to 20% range and FedEx at less than 3%. This is a big deal because, as Axios notes, the U.S. domestic package market was worth about $106 billion last year. And of that, $35 to $40 billion, or about a third, could be credited to e-commerce. And of course, Amazon is about 40% of all e-commerce, so what large percentage of the shipping market is just Amazon shipments? If they're about to take their toys and go home, that's a pretty big hit to a pretty big market. And that's just the beginning of it. Quoting Axios, "Amazon, which has started offering its shipping capabilities as a service to others, will be able to ship products for about two-thirds the rates of UPS and FedEx," Pelas projects. "Its trucks and planes are out-delivering Amazon packages anyway, so it can offer shipping at cost instead of collecting a margin. We're now talking about a retailer that will control the entire process from manufacturing to delivery," says Mark Rosenbaum, a professor at the University of South Carolina. But, while Amazon's suddenly large profile might look menacing, it won't necessarily move as it did in books to knock out its rivals, says Yossi Sheffi, director of MIT's Center for Transportation and Logistics. Quote, "They just want to take all the profitable routes and operations and leave the carriers with all the dogs," end quote.
Hey,
how do you make a password that's strong enough so no one will guess it, and it's impossible for you to forget, and do it for 100 different sites, and make it so everyone in your company can do the same without ever needing to reset them? Sounds impossible unless you have 1Password. More than any other product I've ever told you about, I can vouch 1,000% for 1Password. I can't live without it. 1Password makes strong security easy for your people and gives you the visibility you need to take action when you need to. Any device, anytime, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else. Your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. 1Password's award-winning password manager is trusted by millions of users and over 100,000 businesses from IBM to Slack. It beat out 40 other options to become Wirecutter's top pick for password managers. Right now, my listeners get a free 2-week trial at 1Password.com/ride for your growing business. That's 2 free weeks at 1Password.com/ride. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to 1Password.com/ride. When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months. Or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. You might not have noticed this because it's hard to notice the absence of something, but there are fewer reCAPTCHAs out there in the wider web. Now, it's not that reCAPTCHA is going away, it's just that the latest version of that famous bot detector, version 3, already on 650,000 websites, is completely invisible to users. You don't have to do anything. No parsing pictures or letters, not clicking on an I am not a robot box. The new version of reCAPTCHA can tell you're human just by the way you navigate the site. So that's a good thing, right? One less hassle to worry about. Except, of course, here comes the downside. Google is now using a risk score-based system with reCAPTCHA version 3. And basically, it comes down to if you're signed in with a Google account, the new reCAPTCHA tends to think you're less likely to be a bot almost every time. If you're not signed in to Google, the reCAPTCHA will tend to like you a lot less and be more suspicious of you. And by the way, Google is asking website administrators to embed reCAPTCHA version 3 code on all the pages of their websites, the better to learn how a website's users typically act and thus learn their normal behavior over time. So to sum up, Google has a clever new tool to gather more data on user behavior, though they swear up and down that it won't be used for advertising purposes. But yeah, looked at in a certain light, this could be thought of as yet another example of Google essentially homesteading the entire open web for its own purposes. If you can't be found on Google search, you basically don't exist on the web. We've long made our peace with that. But now, if you don't play ball with Google's reCAPTCHA system to identify legitimate web users, is your site no longer going to be considered part of the legitimate web? And what about users? If we don't play ball with Google systems, to what degree will we be considered at risk or possibly illegitimate internet users? Quoting the Fast Company piece, technology consultant Marcus Perona views Google's use of reCAPTCHA as an outright online land grab, his words, that strengthens Google's hold over the internet. He thinks reCAPTCHA is similar in this way to other Google products like Accelerated Mobile Pages, AMP, a program to make news sites' pages load faster on mobile devices, but has caused some consternation from publishers over whether Google is taking web traffic away from news sites. Same goes for Google Chrome, which the Washington Post recently called surveillance software. Quote, "It's always a double-edged sword," Perona says. "You gain something, but you're also giving Google a little more control over everything online," end quote. Evergreen quote, that one. Time for the weekend long read suggestions. First one comes from Fortune. It's a look at the man who used clever algorithms to make a fortune in the wake of the housing crash, and how he's extending his secret sauce now using AI. Sean Dobson is the CEO of Amherst Holdings, which uses AI to profit from properties most investors wouldn't touch. Quote, "According to Yardeni Research, slightly more than one in three households that would have been buying first homes before the financial crisis is now either renting or still living with their parents. These trends translate into roughly 5 million households that are renting single-family homes rather than taking out mortgages and building equity, and that's Amherst's target market. Its specialty is grabbing rundown properties in nice middle-class subdivisions, guided by algorithms that help it avoid bidding wars and money pits, which it then spruces up for the new rental generation. Amherst's typical customers are couples in their early 40s with one or two kids and household incomes around $60,000. They're paying an average rent of $1,450 a month. Quote, "That's almost exactly what they'd pay on a mortgage and other expenses if they owned the house," says Dobson. "We're catering to a whole new class of Americans, the former buyers who are now either forced renters or renters by choice," end quote. And Dobson is betting that this new class is a permanent one, end quote. Next, a piece from The Ringer continues my efforts to keep an eye on the rise of TikTok, and now especially how it seems to be impacting the music industry. We've spoken already about how many people credit the meme powers of TikTok for the initial breakthrough of the mega hit Old Town Road. And that might just be the beginning. Quote, "Whereas YouTube, Vine, and Instagram are all platforms that lend themselves to music discovery, TikTok demands it. Thanks to the machine learning that powers the app, formerly known as Musical.ly, TikTok needn't rely on a user's social circle to generate recommended content. In the same way a catchy pop song can momentarily meld together a handful of strangers on a dance floor, the right TikTok challenge will connect young people from Los Angeles to Moscow," end quote. Next, have you ever wondered why all of those fancy marketing emails you get in your inbox every day still rely on dumb old HTML tables? Tedium takes a look at how HTML helped and then hindered the evolution of email. And I'd love to talk more about sports tech on this show now and again. So from GeekWire, a look at how the Seattle Seahawks are using data to win on and off the field. And since they recently went public, I thought it was worth putting this piece here about the history of Slack, since I'm not sure many people know the story of Slack. Stuart Butterfield wanted to create an online adventure game called Glitch. He raised $11 million to do so, but, quote, "Once people had a chance to play it and Butterfield could track the numbers, the verdict was clear. Glitch was a flop. There was this night where I just lost faith," Butterfield said in a podcast interview. He decided in 2012 that it was game over. Butterfield made plans to shut down the company and give the remaining money back to his investors. Andrew Brachia, a partner at venture capital firm Accel, wouldn't accept the refund. He and other investors urged Butterfield to keep the remaining $5 million and try something else. That turned into Slack Technologies, the maker of corporate chat software that went public on Thursday. At the close of trading, Slack's market value was $19 billion. Accel invested about $200 million in Slack over 7 years, largely driven by Brachia's unwavering faith in Butterfield. As of the stock debut, Accel held 24% of the company, the biggest VC stake in a newly public unicorn in recent history. Those shares are worth $4.6 billion today, end quote. And finally, this isn't tech, it's art, and it's not a long read, it's a YouTube video. But if you want a quick 7-minute video that explains how modern art progressed from the first inklings of impressionism and abstraction all the way to Jackson Pollock's drip paintings, do this recovering art history minor's heart good and watch the video titled "How Art Arrived at Jackson Pollock." That's all for today and for this week. two weekend bonus episodes this week, and I'm cooking up something special for next weekend, which, especially for the U.S., will basically be a long holiday weekend. So I'm planning something good to listen to while you're traveling to get somewhere, or back from somewhere, I guess, or just to a barbecue, or, I don't know, on a boat or something. Anyway, talk to you on Monday.